unconscious.
I beg pardon, sire. Won't we hit our own troops?
Yes. But we'll hit theirs as well. We have reserves.
Yes, you always have reserves of peasants to use as cannon fodder in your funny little games. White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance radio calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, in the bunker right here in north central Indiana on a very pleasant day. It's overcast, but a nice breeze, and it's just right. Beautiful, right? And you may reach us, of course, at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And that's where you send your fortunes in money and gold, man. And so I can party all night. Right. I don't do much partying around here. About the most partying I do is go sing karaoke. And that's about usually once a week. And that's about enough, so... And maybe a little dancing, a little rock and rolling, yeah, while I'm still able. Yeah, so anyhow, it is the August the 19th, Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. How about that? We miss him. We miss David Lane for sure. And we hate the people who killed him. They happen to be part of the federal government prison system. And they did it. And they deny it, but they did it. And they do it all the time to other people. So no matter whether you're white or black or what, they seem to have fun killing people or driving them crazy. So you got to learn, if they can find you as an individual, it's a very hard way to go. But I studied with a guy who told me what he did in prison camp that kept him sane. Or when they tried to interrogate him, you pick out a spot on the wall, could be any old thing, and just stare at it. Stare at it. And if they knock you to the ground, get up, sit down, and stare at it. And that afforded him a lot of security. So I don't know whether it worked for me or not. Now let's check on our pessimist view of history. And we'll go back to 426 B.C. today. The earthquake shakes Greece. Shortly after, 25 girls in Alponus, Greece, had raced to the top of the harbor tower in order to get a view of the holiday festivals below, a massive earthquake ripped through the eastern Greece, sending the tower and the girls plunging into the sea below. The deadly quake tossed buildings off their foundations, churning and shaking the earth throughout a wide region. Many villages and cities were completely destroyed, and rivers changed their courses or dried up altogether. The peninsula of Euboea, separated from the mainland of Boeotia by a river, was wrenched eastward by the powerful quake. Within minutes, Euboea was an island, and a small river had expanded into a Euripus Strait. Thousands died in the devastating quake, and thousands more were left injured or homeless. That reminds me of what's going on in Japan right now. They're reactivating. See, they turned off all the nuclear power plants, and now they're starting to reactivate them. They've built a giant seawall to help and future type problems like they had before, if that will help. But what they're not talking too much about is it's built right close to an active volcano. Yeah, Japan has many active volcanoes. So here are some of these nuclear plants sitting right beside an active volcano. Well, I don't know what to say about that, but that don't sound too cool to me. Plus, I bet they rebuilt in the same spot to where they were warned hundreds of years ago by markers that were inscribed, "Don't build below these stone markers," which was quite a ways back from the ocean, that the ancestors of the present Japanese had set those up as markers and warned future generations not to. But who listens to the ancestors? Who listens to the senior citizens or whatever? They just go ahead and do it anyhow. What the hell's a few thousand lives? Everything that's built is built around the concept of making the most profit. And that's the problem we've got today, that chasing profit has become more important than anything else. Now, I was listening on the radio today that people down in Brazil are rioting all over the place. Now, a few years ago, Brazil was riding high, expanding greatly. People had money. The poor people were getting somewhere. And now they're back down to a depression. And I was thinking, of course, you know what causes that. And, of course, if you listen to the wise economists, they'll tell you that predatory capitalism and the banks and all that kind of stuff are rushing madly all over the world to invest for a while. If they don't get enough profit, they pull it out and off to another country. So with this massive amounts of funds being put in and taken out of countries on just maybe a couple of years' notice, instead of leaving them set, is throwing the whole balance of the world economy off. And so a nation could be flying high today, and a year from now it could be in totally in the pits, as these predatory capitalists careen from country to country, extracting whatever wealth they can get out of it. And if they don't get enough, they take off someplace else. So that's, if you want to know why all this instability, that's one of the main reasons. Okay, let's go back to 399 BC, the tragic death of Socrates. Socrates, one of the three most important philosophers in ancient Greece, whose teachings eventually became central to Western culture, was condemned to die in 399 after being convicted for corruption of the young and neglect of the gods. I think that could, same thing could happen today to people. The very greatness of Socrates made the mean circumstances of his death that much more tragic. His indictment was in large part of a result of the political instability of Athens after the Peloponnesian War. You see, here's another instance where wars tear you down. And it's not so much even the wars, it's the aftermath of the wars, the ripples that go out in every area of society. So you may think you won a war, but you really didn't win a war at all. Because there's usually a depression that follows every war, if not massive disease. Furthermore, when accused, Socrates responded contemptuously to the charges against him and refused to request banishment rather than execution as his penalty. Unfortunately, he had his way and was condemned to poison himself with hemlock. On the day appointed for his death, possibly in the spring or summer, Socrates' friends arrived in the prison as the jailers were removing his chains. Quote, "How singular is the thing called pleasure, and how curiously related to pain," unquote, the philosopher mused as his leg chains he had worn for a month were loosened. Socrates, who taught that death would only liberate soul from its bodily fetters, faced his own death calmly. He told his friends that the soul, adorned in her own proper jewels, which are temperance, justice, courage, nobility, and truth, is ready to go on her journey to the world below. Well, I liked his ideas on temperance, justice, courage, nobility, and truth, but to assign it to a mystical, abstract soul, I get off the boat. The philosopher smiled ironically when asked how he wanted to be buried. Quote, "When I have drunk the poison, I shall leave you and go to the joys of the blessed," unquote, he answered, which is similar to what they preach in all these religions today. as far as I'm concerned, are they going to get a big surprise? Quote, be of good cheer and say that you are burying my body only, and do with that as usual, and as you think best. Well, that's what you're doing, and that's fine. Replenishing the earth. Socrates then bathes, saying he wanted to spare the women the trouble of washing his body once he was dead. Then he met for the final time with his children and the women of his family. As sundown came, he prepared to accept the poison, scorning those who urged him to delay his death a few more hours. The jailer who brought the cup of poison broke into tears, calling Socrates, quote, the noblest and gentlest and best of all who ever came to this place, unquote. Socrates asked for permission to make libation to the gods with the poison, but was told that there was only enough for him to drink. He raised the cup and prayed, quote, for the gods to prosper my journey from this to that other world, unquote, and drank without hesitation. Instructing his weeping friends to be quiet and patient so that he could die in peace, Socrates walked around his prison cell until his legs felt heavy. He lay down and felt the numbing effect of the poison working its way up his legs, saying, quote, when the poison reaches the heart, that will be the end, unquote. His last words were simply, I owe a cock to Asclepius, the god of healing. Will you remember to pay the debt, unquote. Then the philosopher, who had spent his life preaching the immortality of the soul, fell silent, his eyes glazed over in death. Well, I'm sure Socrates was a very wise man, but as far as I'm concerned, he was not wise about soul or all that kind of stuff. More abstraction, more mysticism, more maybe, could be, but doubtful. That's from T.T.'s point of view. If you want to believe in the spooks in the sky, of course, nobody can stop you. Nobody can make you either. So anyhow, you're an independent contractor. Now, tomorrow, the next issue, that we go back to 390 B.C., when the Gauls, those dirty progenitors to the strong white race of Europe, burnt Rome. Yeah. I often wondered how easy it was to burn a place like Rome, because it's mostly rock. I mean, you could burn the curtains and all that stuff on the inside, but that seemed to me a thankless job to try to burn down a city made of stone. But anyhow, that's what we're going to cover tomorrow, when the heathen come down hard on Rome, the other heathens. I remember when I was a little kid being forced by threat of violence to go to church, that I used to wonder about that word heathen. It sounded sort of cool to me, because everything that these Christ insanity people were liking and condemning in the heathen, I thought that was pretty good. I sometimes thought, gee, I'd like to be one of those heathens. I was listening for a few minutes, as I do quite often, a black radio station, a black talk show guy that was putting down an older man, a black man that was a teacher and was still teaching. And the point the older black man was making was, back in the day, even in the 50s, when he was teaching, all of the black students in his all-black segregated school went on to high school. But now, he says, half of the black kids go to high school not able to read. And so he was saying that no matter what you thought of segregated schools, they turned out smarter, more educated black students. And this young black guy, he was trying every way he could to disparage the guy's ideas, but he really couldn't, because it's a matter of fact, it's a matter of statistic, that the more the schools were integrated and all the other problems that went with it, the less able the graduating students were to go on and even to read. So anyhow, it was an interesting conversation. That's why the other day I described the all-black school in, let's see, what place was that? Dade City, Florida, where we live near, but we used to drive up there for some reason. And like I said, an all-black school, and it was well kept. Plenty of nice cars in the parking lot. The teachers, when they were outside, were wearing suits and ties, sort of like the Muslim, black Muslims today. And the kids were all dressed neatly and nicely. And so I'm sure that many of those black kids did very well. And that was before anything was desegregated. Yesterday I was hearing about them trying to accuse Assad of Syria of using mustard gas against people, of which they supposedly had evidence and picked horrible pictures. We know how that goes. These pictures can be reformulated and reformatted and photoshopped and everything else. But even if Assad had used mustard gas, and all the media here in this country are saying what a horrible man he is, well, we've spread nuclear waste all over the Middle East that came from our weapons and our guns and our cannon shells and all that kind of stuff. We've literally spread it, depleted uranium everywhere, which will last thousands of years. And there's massive birth defects in Iraq and Afghanistan and all these places where they use this stuff. And yet, this sanctimonious son of a bitch in government points a finger at a Middle East leader because he may have used mustard gas. I'll tell you, when I hear all this stuff, it makes me so damn sick. You want to do something about it, but you say, wait a minute. How am I going to get a handle on this damn thing? And here again, I come back to the fact that worse is better, and it's got to go down, 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 until there's hopefully a collapse of some type. Well, I see from the state capitol here in Indiana, they're sticking to $7.25 an hour, calling that a living wage. $7.25 an hour is barely a survival wage, as rents and everything go up for these poor people. I've noticed around here that there's a growing upper class and a growing lower class. And I don't mean people who don't have any class. I'm talking about poor, poor, poor white people that don't know what the hell is going on. They're walking around like they're in a daze. They dress like peasants, talk like peasants, act like peasants. And these sons of bitches will only pay him $7.25 an hour. Also, the big thing about heroin started, you know. Now, what's the big surprise? Afghanistan is floating in heroin, and U.S. troops are helping to cultivate and helping to smuggle it. And so heroin's become super cheap on the street in Europe and the United States. But they don't start the story with that. They just say, oh, surprise, surprise, we got a massive outbreak of heroin. Well, how could that have happened? You know, they don't start, these news media, they don't start the story with the origin of the problem. They just talk about the effect. And so heroin use has doubled, tripled, and even more. And up in Chicago is one of the worst. And I guess they want to feed this heroin to the black people to keep them calm and docile and easy to handle when they throw them into clink. Because there's sure no real benefit to society by allowing massive distribution of heroin. And like I've said before, with problems like that, there's only one way in the end you take care of it. And that's a bullet in the back of the head. big-time distributors of heroin, which many of them are politicians and in the government, should pay the price. And they're not going to put them in prison, or if they do put them into prison, it won't be for very long. So there's only one way to clean out a country when it gets to this point with, say, heroin usage. And that is to sail May, as the Vietnamese used to say. No, the Chinese, sail May. You deprive them of life. That's it. But is that going to happen? No, it's not going to happen, because too many people at the top are making too much money. Just like with illegal aliens. The profit is there. As long as the profit's there, predatory capitalism is going to be milking it. And all these people running for office on the Republican ticket especially are promoting that kind of activity. And, you know, they have their rights. They have rights to be heroin addicts. And we don't have a right to do anything to protect society. Another thing, while I'm drinking my coffee in the morning, I noticed that all these progressives coming out of the woodwork crying about the black people, you know. Well, I'm first to admit that cops overdo it in many cases, and there's far too many people in prison and things like that. But these same progressives or liberals or whatever you want to call them are going to be the ones, as time goes on, to scream the loudest when they call and the cop don't show up. Believe me, they're gonna scream to high heaven, these liberals and progressives, when they call and the cop don't show up. I remember a couple of times in California when they had the blue flu or the green flu or whatever uniform color the cops were wearing. People got up really uptight and excited. The upper class did. However, I did notice that whenever the police stayed home in sort of a wildcat walkout, crime went down. The crime rate went down. Well, that's simple. People say, well, how could that be? Well, because there's not near as many people being arrested on Mickey Mouse charges. Simple as that. And so the more heavy-duty crimes get looked at a little bit more by a skeleton force. But all these petty bullshit crimes people are rousted on the street for, it's not happening. And it's not really changing society or hurting anything at all. So, but anyhow, I think it's going to be funny in some of these cities, like Ferguson, Missouri, when things really go to shit. And these people are calling for the cops, and the cops are going to say, forget it, forget it. And even though I know the problems with cops, and I'm no great supporter of the idea of law enforcement officers, I'm a supporter of peace officers, that's a whole different story. Indiana legislators are like other legislators. They're a bunch of assholes, and they're lazy. And so they're arguing over whether to send convicted pedophiles absentee ballots. I'm not shitting you. They have a big argument here in Indiana about whether to let the pedophiles have absentee ballots, which is not particularly one way or the other, but it's going to be a big cost of money to put a program that in action. And also, they came up with now, you know, they have the convicted pedophile maps on the internet. You can see how many of your neighbors are pedophiles. I haven't checked lately, but I think the last time I checked, within about a mile, there were two or three of them. And now the police, state police, have come out with a new map. And this is where meth hideouts have been busted. Well, what the hell good is that to let us know where meth has been and is gone, and the people are gone, and there's people arrested and put in jail? What the hell good is it to tell me where they were except just to scare the shit out of little old ladies, I guess. Boy, I'll tell you, now that, I wonder how much that's going to cost to produce that kind of a thing on the internet. Well, I'm going to go right up there and find out so I can take over some of these places and brew my own meth. Cops have already been there. They probably won't suspect anybody would do it again. Just kidding, boys and girls. I hate meth. The ACLU's got into it about this thing about sex offenders and absentee ballots. And they're crying on the radio about how this is going to seriously affect the sex offender. This is a terrible thing. Jesus. Yeah. I guess you've noticed how much advertising there is on TV and radio. It's just increased over and over. It's doubled and tripled to where you have maybe 15 minutes out of every hour that's straight advertising. And then all the new advertising videos are full of non-whites hugging and kissing whites. And hauling white nigger babies around, white couples and all that. So whoever's behind that kind of stuff is very sick puppies. We noticed it 20 years ago in California that it was increasing this in picture advertising from the department stores. They were adding more and more Negroes and then gradually combining little Negro children with the white children, and then gradually the Negro guys with the white women, and then gradually, you know, it just keeps going. I quit ISIS Radio, that I'd been a customer for at least 20 years, because even in a talk show, most talk shows, they take a break and there's at least 5 minutes or 7 minutes of ads. And usually ads about crap I don't want to hear about. And so I quit it. Now, most of this stuff you can find free on the internet, which I just, that's what I did. It's not quite as convenient. But one thing funny, I had 3 units at one time in 2 cars in a house. That had the ISIS radio. And so I quit 2 of them last year. And I called them to get rid of it, get rid of them all. And I had to argue with some guy over in the Philippines where they don't even get this radio channel. Finally, I got through him, and I checked one of my units out, and it's still working. Yeah. So I got one of mine. I'm still getting the programming, and my account is canceled. What do you think I ought to do? Well, I know what I'm going to do. Since they rip us off, we got to rip them off once in a while. I see the Right Reverend Al Sharpton's coming to Fort Wayne. That's about an hour's drive from me. I'm tempted to go up there and go into that black church and check him out. I'm not sure. I might do that. Al Sharpton. The last time I was on stage with him, I almost punched him in the mouth and told him he was a rat and he wasn't a good black leader at all. And he was screwing his people for fun and profit. I wonder if he'd remember me if I went in there and presented myself to the Right Reverend Al Sharpton. He has a radio show, too, on Sirius, not ISIS. I keep thinking ISIS. It's Sirius. And he's almost impossible to listen to. He's such an ignoramus. I'm going to think this over whether I go up there. It's amazing how they treat him with such high respect, the things he's done. It just shows you how they give a lot of blacks a free ticket. Because, I mean, the Tawana Brawley thing, I guess people forget all about. A total fraud that a black girl claimed that she was raped by 3 white men. And they carved, painted stuff on her chest and all that kind of stuff. It turned out to be a total fraud. Well, if that didn't destroy him, then there was a when the Jews and the blacks were having a problem in Brooklyn, and there was a demonstration took place out in front of this Jew's shop, and Sharpton's out there pushing the crowd to go in and get him and kill him, screaming, "Go in and kill him, go in and kill him." Those are the things Al Sharpton does, but somehow he seems to be a protected item. He was on the TV channel there, and he was terrible. I mean, it couldn't possibly be a straight deal, honest deal, to have him as a spokesman on TV. It was on a liberal television network. So anyhow, he's got something on somebody. He has to have something on somebody. But I got something on him. Al, you're an asshole. And you'll never change. But you laugh all the way to the bank because you owe hundreds of thousands, maybe $1 million in taxes. And you haven't been arrested. Well, guess what? We've got a West Nile outbreak here in Indiana. Boy, I'll tell you, we're getting everything from all over the place around here because it's the meth become the meth capital. Indiana's become the meth capital. AIDS is breaking out. Everything that I left in California has followed me here, and now West Nile. It's not West Nile. It was from Israel. Israel agriculture is where this disease came from, and it comes from being bitten by a mosquito carrying the virus. And so there's a lot of mosquitoes out here. I know when I walk into my backyard, they're all over me, so I'm going to stay out of the backyard and put plenty of mosquito juice on me. But beware if you're living in an area, especially here in Indiana now, where a lot of people have gotten sick with West Nile, but don't call it West Nile. It was from Israel, and that was became news years ago, but nobody talks about it today. Oh, West Nile. Well, what do you mean, West Nile?
Well, I mean Israel, goddamn.
See, that Al Sharpton appearance is going to be at the Come As You Are church. Well, that's how I'll do it. I'll come as you are. Come as I is. So 27 counties in Indiana have been found to have mosquitoes with West Nile kike virus. 27 counties, that's a lot of the state. Well, I guess that's not as bad as California fires in the Northwest. I wonder what Harold Covington and his Move to the Northwest program is going to say about this, you know, as the whole damn Northwest seems to be burning down with, I think they had 90 fires going. Now, they claim that is lightning, and I'm sure a lot of it is, but I said a long time ago that if I was Al-Qaeda or ISIS and nasty, the easiest thing in the world would be to start fires, you know. They throw a road flare out the window and off they go. I mean, just think of what would happen if they hit the wheat fields and stuff with that. So this country is far more vulnerable than it realizes, and it doesn't take modern advanced weapons to do it. Some of these fires, I'm sure, in California were set by people who were pissed off. For sure, a whole lot of them are from illegal aliens, because I remember that from Fallbrook, where I used to live. The illegal aliens that the progressives love so much, they have their camps down in the valleys, in the ravines, and up on the ridges, all these rich white Republicans build their big houses. And when these illegals start their fires to keep warm. And, of course, they stupidly let it get out of control, and up the hills it went. They go. And guess what's at the top of the hill? The big rich man's houses. Here about 10 years ago, not quite that long ago, they had a major fire there that burned out all kinds of wealthy people's homes. of all these illegal aliens that they've made money off of and love so much. So it karma, it comes back, I guess. It comes back. And so Covington's up there. He's going to be sitting on a smoldering pile of rubble that he calls the Northwest Imperative. I hope you've got your asbestos jockey shorts on there, Tubby. Old Tubby would be living in pretty good style back in North Carolina around Greensboro, I guess, if he hadn't committed some bad things against people and got a big judgment of thousands of dollars against him, and he fled the state. And that's why he was up in the Northwest, not because he was looking to form an empire in the Northwest, but because everybody was out to get him and make him pay what he owed in the trial. And so that's the situation there. So he said, well, since I got to flee to an area where they can't get me, well, I'll go up here and then I'll start this Northwest Imperative and I'll build my empire, man. But the last time I checked, old Tubby was living pretty close to the water. Pretty well down there to the closer to the beach, man. He ain't going to be out there in the backcountry with the hardcore people. You know that story about heroin I told you a while back? Obama's being big. He's going to allocate $5 million to study it. $5 million, that's a drop in the bucket of what's needed when you have a heroin epidemic. $5 million. You sure don't think much of his black people, his black brothers, because that's where the lion's share of the heroin use is among the blacks. You know, the drug industry, the big ones are more dangerous than street drugs. They're killing this country. Over-the-counter crap. I remember I came back when my mother was still alive and she had a whole shelf full of this bullshit and most of it was causing her to be worse. And I threw it all out, almost all of it. Now they're going to allow kids to have OxyContin. OxyContin is one of the most powerful pain pills around. Pretty soon it's going to be Percocet and all these others. These are all very dangerous drugs. Adults shouldn't even be taking them except extreme situations. And let me play you a little clip here.
The practice of medicine. What it does is make these guidelines, and the FDA representative has stressed that the drug's approval is not intended to expand or intend to change the way it's used for pediatric patients. That was according to Newsweek. So the approval is for children 11 and older who are already tolerating a minimum daily dose of at least 20 milligrams per day. So this is what blows my mind. Yeah. They're just kind of like, oh, well, you're already giving it to these kids, and we're kind of going to say, yeah, sure, that's fine. So yeah. There's these sort of off-label uses, which aren't necessarily banned or illegal to use. They just said, yeah, someone's already having, if some 11-year-old's already tolerating.
Well, you can't blame the FDA, because when they asked, you know, would this be harmful to children, they went to the experts on whether or not it would be harmful to children. They went to the companies. Maker. They went to Purdue Pharma, who makes OxyContin. They released, gave the FDA report saying it doesn't hurt kids at all as long as it's properly prescribed and used and done, you know, as long as it's done within the guidelines, kids will be fine.
Right.
Go right to the maker of the drug. That person's going to give you the honest dope.
That's like asking a gun company to tell you about whether or not guns are safe around kids. Yeah. Oh, they're safe.
I can make a joke, but this is a very serious problem. I mean, according to the National Institutes of Health, approximately 2.1 million Americans are struggling with an addiction to prescription painkillers. 2.1 million. It is one of the rising, most powerful addictions going on around the world, not just in America. And according to the CDC, unintentional poisoning deaths from prescription opioids have quadrupled from 1999 to 2010, and they now outnumber those from heroin and cocaine combined. Wow.
And a lot of this, they could, you know, there's a lot of this, you know, argument over where is this coming from, but there's a very clear connection between over-prescription of drugs prior to the financial crisis and this large uptick in abuse of heroin.
And then when you get into the drug war, where you get into like Obama's drug war, you know what he's trying to do to help things in the drug department, $5 million.
It's nothing. I mean, Thomas McClellan, who is President Obama's chief scientist for drug control policy from 2009 to 2012, had said there are research-tested, cost-effective public health and public safety measures that could reduce opioid use and related deaths, but not at this price. I hope they ultimately take this problem seriously and provide the commitment the public is looking for. And that's it. You have 5 million people, and you've or a million people who are suffering from these addictions, and you throw in 5 million, and it's not even all going to treatment. So the extra $5 a person is not going to make a difference. We need to treat addicts better in this country. They have an illness, and you treat the disease of addiction.
Yes.
And then you won't have a need for it.
Well, that's just a little off-the-cuff information on the drug situation. And you've heard it on the news. A lot of times you get the news just as fast or maybe before I do. And these big drug companies, now this Purdue drug company that's involved in this, I think that's an offshoot of Eli Lilly in Indianapolis because of the name Purdue, because we have the Purdue University down there. And all that. So I just have a feeling it's either a spin-off or a part of Eli Lilly, which have been pushing dangerous drugs for decades. And these drug companies are going to have to be brought to their knees. I mean, literally. The people just have to get totally upset and uptight and do something even physical about it. Otherwise, well, might as well not bitch about it. So if you're one of these pill poppers and one of our friends, get off of it. Get away from that stuff. Find something natural to do. Something that is not dangerous to your health and your kid's health and your wife's health and your dog's health and so on. Well, let's spend the rest of the show visiting the Jew. The Jew comes to America. We'll pick up here where I left off. Not a bit of it. When the Mirdanians of the law came to levy upon the bondsmen, they found them to be men of straw, that their property had vanished into thin air, and not a dollar was ever confiscated to the state. Jew to duplicity had won the day, and the law, as it so often is the case when dealing with a Jew criminal, had been effectually baffled and set at naught. This same Judas Iscariot Kurtz, alias Sheeny Mike, the betrayer of the Mammy Bomb, is himself a notorious Jew criminal. He's been operating as a crook for the past 20 years. His boon companions have been murderers as well as thieves. Kurtz was first heard of as a burglar in Philadelphia, where he robbed several jewelry stores. He has the reputation of being quick to observe the peculiar construction of buildings about to be plundered and to discover the best point of attack. He is an expert at safe blowing and as a safe blower and a breaker, and his specialty in plunder is jewelry and silk. Kurtz has been arrested so many times it would be tedious to enumerate them all. He was arrested in New York City in February of 1877 for a burglary at a clothes house of the Hahn Benjamin Company, 315 Broadway. The Jew thief managed to escape punishment for this crime, but the Gentile Confederate one, Dutch Chris, was of course convicted and sent to jail. In the very same year, Kurtz was again in the clutches of the law, this time in Baltimore, Maryland, on the charge of robbing a silk house of Scott and Company of that city. Upon this occasion, there was no opportunity to give the state's evidence, turning traitor, betraying a Confederate, and the Jew thief found himself under a righteous sentence of 12 years in prison. But this Jew, his Jew cunning and the natural Jew aptitude for duplicity was still left him in this dire emergency. This reminds me of that outfit that I'm trying to think on the West Coast, that carpet cleaning business that was set up by this Jew, which we, Tom Tom, I can't even remember his name anymore. I haven't heard from him so long. Had set up. And he got busted and went to prison. Supposed to get 25 years. And he was out in a couple of years because he did this turn Christian. And this Jew became a preacher in the prison. And they let him out in about 3 years. There's a Jew for you. Barry somebody. I'm trying to think of his name. I'll think of it as we go along. But his Jew cunning and natural Jew aptitude for duplicity was still left him in his dire emergency. He had not been long behind the jailhouse bars when he hit upon a happy plan, purloining all prison soap upon which he could lay his square-nailed Jewish claws. He ate it in quantities which had an effect of making him extremely pale and wan-looking. He assumed sanctimonious airs, sighing and groaning a good deal, and posed generally as a moribund. So skillfully did he carry out his role of dissimulation that he was pardoned by the Governor Butler in 1880 upon the strength of a report by the overcredulous prison physician that Kurtz was dying. Having regained his liberty, Kurtz gave up the soap habit and was promptly restored to robust health, so that early in the next first month of the ensuing year, 1881, he felt strong enough to break into a silk warehouse in Washington, D.C. and carry off $5,000 worth of silks. Now remember, that's 1881 money. He continued in an active and highly remunerative career of crime until July 1882, when he broke into the safes of an Italian-American bank in New York City, for which crime he was arrested. The witnesses were, however, bought off, and the lucky Jew thief again escaped. A couple of vagrants who had been lounging in City Hall Park had seen Kurtz break into the bank and had furnished a description of him to the detectives, which had led to his arrest. At the trial, these vagrants were utterly unable to identify him. Kurtz was arrested in August 1883 on a warrant issued by the United States Commissioner Osborne, charging him with larceny of jewelry from the Charles F. Wood of Washington, D.C. The prisoner was liberated upon bail, and while awaiting trial, the jewelry store of Marks and Son at Troy, New York, was broken into and robbed of stock worth $14,000. Suspicion pointed at Sheeny Mike, and he was hunted for. Kurtz fled to England and France, where he committed a series of burglaries which netted him nearly $100,000. Returning to the United States, Kurtz, with one of his brothers, who for a long time kept a cigar store on 8th Avenue near 13th Street, bought out a tobacco factory in Jacksonville, Florida. In November 1885, 2 months after the building was burned, and the publication of the fire led to the discovery of the fugitive crook's whereabouts. He was arrested for the Troy burglary, and after a bitter legal contest in Florida courts, was taken to Troy for trial. He was convicted in the Marks robbery and sentenced to 18 years and 6 months imprisonment. But since the Jews had contrived to secure for him a new trial, Solomon Stern, confidence operator and speculator in bogus checks before he was run to earth by detectives in June 1883, and succeeded in swindling a large number of merchants of New York City of large quantities of jewelry and other valuables by means of bogus checks. He began his operation while salesman in his father's store and started by robbing the old man. The bogus check operator had a Jewish mistress whom he decorated with stolen diamonds and also lived with for a while at fashionable seaside hotels. Before his arrest, Stern stole over $5,000 worth of goods from his father's store. To a check which the robber and swindler passed C.W. Schumann, diamond dealer at 24 John Street, New York, Stern forged his mother's name. The check on the Germania Bank was accepted, and after getting the diamonds and change in full amount, Stern and his female companion fled to Baltimore, Maryland. But as soon as the money was spent, the pair returned to New York City. On other bogus checks, he purchased a sealskin sack worth $250 from Henry Propach, furrier of number 819 Broadway, and a precious stone worth $425 from A.R. Picard, a jeweler on Fifth Street. Then, having grown tired of his mistress, he betrayed her into the hands of the police and fled to parts unknown. Now, this is an example of a Jew. Of a Jew swindler and a Jew con man and a Jew robber. He was next heard of in January 1883 when he swindled Joseph Michael of number 150 Ewan Street in Brooklyn out of $800 by giving a worthless check in payment for jewelry. In the latter part of the year, the crafty rascal was finally trapped in New York City. There were a dozen or more indictments on file against him at the time of his arrest. When brought up to trial, he pleaded guilty to the charge on which he was arraigned and was sentenced to 5 years in state prison by Judge Gildersleeve in the court of General Sessions. Stern is now at large. Rogue, swindler, thief, plunderer of his father, forger of his mother's name, betrayer of his female companion in crime, of the woman who had nursed him in sickness and who had served him with unquestionable, questioning and uncalculating fidelity, of a dumb beast. What Aryan criminal, no matter how lost, how based, how vile, can show such a record as this scoundrel Jew? Frank Lowenthal, alias Sheeny Irving, alias August W. Irwin, shoplifter, receiver of stolen goods, desperado and adventurers, is a graduate of the University of Heidelberg. He was for some time connected with a St. Louis newspaper under Jew management. He was first arrested in New York City in September 1882 for larceny of opera glasses with a jewelry store in Maiden Lane. Julius Klein, alias Sheeny Julius, another notorious Hebrew thief, was arrested with Lowenthal for the same offense but was not held. Sheeny Irving was let out upon $500 bail, and no effort was made to prosecute him for the robbery. He next became a receiver of stolen goods. Lowenthal fell in with an Aryan young woman, the daughter of a millionaire proprietor of a Washington laundry in the Ninth Ward of New York City. Against the wishes of her parents, the young girl married Sheeny Irving. Her father, when he found that Lowenthal was a thief, was anxious to separate the couple. Well, he should have separated the thief from his head. The Jew's son-in-law demanded a sum of money, which was refused, and it was arranged to take the girl to Europe. Lowenthal became aware of the scheme, and at the Almond House in East 10th Street, he made a desperate attempt to murder his young wife. The girl, however, recovered, and on September 21, 1885, Lowenthal was sentenced to 5 years in state prison by Recorder Smythe. You start to catch on to this. You know, Jews always claim, oh, you're anti-Semitic. You hate the Jews. We're good people. We don't do things wrong. We love the Yahweh. We love the Jehovah. David Goldstein, alias Sheeny Dave, alias Lewis, alias Levitt, sneak thief and shoplifter, is well known to the authorities of New York State. He was arrested in Buffalo, New York in January 1878 for pilfering various small articles from jewelry stores. For that offense, he was sent to Auburn Prison for 1 year. Upon his release, he was taken to Baltimore, Maryland to stand trial for a similar crime, which he was suspected of having committed there prior to his capture in Buffalo. He was not convicted of the latter charge. Under the alias James Lewis, Goldstein was arrested in New York City in January 1881 for the larceny of silk from the store of Edward Freitman and Company, 473 Spring Street. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced by Judge Cowing to 2 years and 6 months imprisonment in Sing Sing. Goldstein was arrested again in New York City in December 1883 for stealing diamonds from Kirkpatrick's jewelry store on Broadway. The prisoner then gave the name Samuel Newman. He jumped his bail, and on September 1884 he was caught picking pockets in New York County, Maine, and was sentenced to 3 years imprisonment under the name of Herman Lewis. Goldstein is now a fugitive from justice in New York City. George Levi, alias Lee, shoplifter and sneak thief, was carried on operations in the eastern cities and passed some of his time behind the bars of Sing Sing prison and the penitentiary on Blackwell's Island. A quantity of Japanese goods was stolen from a store of Charles W. Fuller at number 15 East 19th Street on June 7, 1882. Levy was arrested for robbery and when brought up for trial before Police Justice Murray at the Tombs Police Court, the latter, ignorant of the character of the glib-tongued prisoner, discharged him from custody. He was next arrested in September 1885 in the fur store of Solomon Kootner at 492 Broome Street. The wife of the proprietor of the place noticed that Levy carried a light overcoat under his arm and that it was much larger than when the supposed customer entered her store. The woman stopped the rogue at the door and stood before him. Interposed between him and the carrying off of his plunder was a woman. What a frail barrier to an interposed against Jew avarice and the lust of possession. Without an instant's hesitation, the Jew thief attacked the woman with utmost savagery, beating her, gouging her eyes, and even attempting to tear them out with claw-like fingers of his race. In his maddening at being baffled in the bearing off of his plunder, he would probably have gotten his Jew caution and would have murdered her, had not the woman's husband, attracted by the noise of the struggle, came to her aid and assistance, seized the thief and held him until the arrival of the police. It was then found that he had a valuable seal sack concealed under his overcoat. He was sentenced to 3 years imprisonment. As a blackmailer, the Hebrew can also be particularly adept, as is shown by the career of Jewess Sophia Levy, alias Louis Sylvan, a notorious shoplifter, pickpocket, blackmailer. She has two sons who are thieves. Sophia was arrested for grand larceny in October 1871 and was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment. She escaped from Sing Sing prison in December 1872. 4 years later, she was caught picking pockets at Suffolk County Long Island Fair. In Boston, Mass., a few years afterwards, under the alias Louise Sylvan, she gained considerable notoriety as a blackmailer. She lured a wealthy merchant of that city to her room in a hotel. She hid his clothing. To secure his release, Sophia Levy made her dupe fill out a check for $10,000. The merchant was kept prisoner until the check, which had been handed to a Confederate, had been presented to the bank. The check called for more money than the merchant had on deposit at the time. This led to the exposure of the blackmailing plot, and the woman was arrested. The merchant, doubtless owing to fear and publicity, rapidly refused to prosecute. She was next arrested in Grand Rapids. You see where this is going? It's this way today if you read the crime reports like in New York City and Chicago. In 1883, for attempting to blackmail a prominent citizen of that place, Sophia Levy was convicted of this charge and sentenced to 3 years imprisonment in the Detroit House of Correction. In 1886, she was convicted of stealing silk from a store of Koch and Sons on 6th Avenue, New York, and sentenced to 6 months in the penitentiary on Blackwell Island. She is an opium eater, drug addict, and her mother was a shoplifter. Bertha Schlesinger, Carco, alias Bertha Heyman, alias Big Bertha, alias the Confidence Queen, has operated all over the United States and is well known to the New York detectives as a very shrewd Jewish criminal. She first became notorious about 10 years ago, and in 1880 she was sued in Superior Court of New York for obtaining $1,035 by falsely pretensing from E.T. Perrin, a palace car conductor whom she met while traveling from Chicago. At London, Ontario, she was arrested on February 1881 for defrauding a Montreal commercial man out of $500 by a confidence game. Since then, she's been arrested for swindling Pauline Schlarbaum of Southfield, Long Island, out of $400, Charles Brandt, a liquor merchant, at number 19 Bowery, out of $960, Theodore W. Morris, glass importer, out of $500, and Edward Saunders of the firm of Saunders and Hoffman Brokers, Broadway and Fulton Street, out of $450 in money and a diamond pin. Such is her cunning and adeptness in crime. Even when a prisoner in a penitentiary on Blackwell's Island, serving out a term of imprisonment, she swindled a man named Charles Carp out of $900. After committing a number of mean robberies, she eloped with another Jewess's husband and went to San Francisco, California, where she victimized a number of persons. She escaped from there and was subsequently captured at San Antonio, Texas, and is at present under arrest. While in New York City, she had rooms at the Hoffman House and represented that she was worth $8,000. And that's 1800s money. $8,000 today? Gee, that'd be probably at least $50,000. Emmanuel Marx, alias Mike Marx, alias Redheaded Jew, is a bank sneak, thief, confidence operator, and skin gambler. He is from Chicago and on March 12, 1882, escaped from jail at Detroit, Michigan. He was last heard of in Canada. Charles Woodward, alias Williams, alias Hoyt, alias Anderson, alias Henderson, is known to detectives as a Jew, diamond swallower, sneak thief, and pennyweight, gold thief. He became notorious in 1879, January, when he was arrested for stealing a trunk containing $15,000 worth of jewelry from a traveling salesman at the Palmer House in Chicago. He has since been arrested several times in New York State. William Haig, alias James Martin, alias Curly Harris, is a Jew murderer and burglar and hotel sneak thief. He is known to the police as one of the most desperate thieves and ruffians in America. He shot policeman Murphy in Philadelphia some years ago and escaped to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he was captured. On his way back to the scene of his crime, he jumped out the window of the train and got away. Haig, on August 25, 1879, at 8th and Swanson Streets, Philadelphia, murdered James Riley, alias John Davis, another thief. He was captured and sent to prison, and his sentence of 10 years expired June 3, 1888. The list of Jews who have been sent to prison during the last 20 years for setting fire to buildings so as to fraudulently collect the insurance money is a startling long one. The records of the New York Fire Marshal's office show that a large percentage of the persons arrested for arson are Jews, and that two-thirds of the fires yearly occurring in the city of New York are in buildings occupied by Jews. Many of the insurance companies arbitrarily and systematically refuse to issue policies to Jews. This is a statement which is readily susceptible of verification. The Jew firebug is a very hard bug to convict. Long before he applies the lurid torch or sprinkles his premises with inflammable oil, he has plenty of witnesses on his accursed race, all primed and fixed to prove an alibi, to swear that the firebug was out of the city, or mayhap prostrating himself before the tables of the law in the synagogue. In that time, the fire broke out of his place. It's a matter of much difficulty legally to prove a case of arson. Under the existing conditions of the law, and a large percentage of Jew incendiaries who were brought to trial managed to escape conviction. The law should promptly be changed with a view to specifically meeting the case of Jew incendiary, the criminal who does not hesitate to consign the sleeping inmates of a household, men and women and little children, to a horrible death for the sake of fraudulently collecting a few hundred or a few thousand dollars of insurance money. What form of crime can be conceived more monstrous than that of the Jew incendiary? In spite of the difficulty there is under the existing condition of the law in most states of the Union, it is satisfactorily establishing a case of arson. A large number of Jews have in recent years been convicted of this heinous crime and suitably punished. In the various state prisons throughout the country, there are numbers of Jews serving out life sentences or long terms of imprisonment for this offense. To enumerate anything like all these cases of this character for which Jew criminals have been responsible in, let us say the last 10 years, would make a tediously long list. Let it suffice to detail a comparatively few cases occurring within the period named in New York City, and let these instances serve as a sample of the whole. Well, we'll go on to that maybe tomorrow or another day. That's it for today, 14-5, and think white, act white, be white, and 14-5, especially 5.
Bigots. The Pope wars on the Catholic Emperor. Your generals are bandits. Wars on the Catholic King of France. You employ any mercenary you can get. Wars on the Catholic King of Spain. And the Pope plays politics, helped by 100 other princes, kings, bishops.
All for their own rotten purposes.
All sides are rotten, except for people like you. Religious fanatics who incite murder for the sake of a God they have never known. Don't you understand?
That's from the great film The Last Valley. If you've never seen it, you should see it, with Michael Caine and the fellow that just died, Omar Sharif. Great film, great film.